Bonsoir. So we'll do it in French tonight. That's very good news. Everybody speaks French here. So my name is Pascal Perzo. I'm the executive director of Aspen France. And it's my pleasure to welcome all of you for this panel on Europe with our distinguished panelists, which most of them are coming from Europe, one from US. They did a long trip to be at Aspen tonight with us, and I'm very pleased, and I thank you very much, all of you, to be with us tonight. Michel Pébreau, the chairman of Aspen France, was supposed to be with us on this panel. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know what to say, President Sarkozy, the new president of France, invited him for a meeting tomorrow morning, so it was really, really complicated for him to be with us tonight. I think it's a good news for the Aspen network. It means that new leaders in France are listening to Aspen ideas and Aspen inputs. So I thought that's a good news for us tonight. And so he's really sorry not to be with us tonight, but have two members of my board who will be part of the panel, so they will be able to talk about Aspen France. On behalf of Raymond Barre, Raymond Barre was the Prime Minister of France. He is our honorary chairman of Aspen France. And I would like to say that we are really proud, Aspen France, to be part of the third edition of the Aspen Ideas Festival. It's new for us. Last year, we wanted to have a panel on Europe. It was not very easy to organize it. And today, we have been able to organize this panel on Europe. And it's very, very good idea, I think, for the Europe, for the American, and for the Aspen network also. And perhaps you don't know this story, but in the early 50s, in Aspen, Colorado, some French people were talking about Europe. And there is one famous French person. His name was Jean Monnet. He's one of the father of Europe with Robert Schuman. And Jean Monnet, in the early 50s, spent time in Aspen, Colorado to talk about Europe and to talk about the future of Europe before the treaty in 1957. So it's like we just come back. We just wanted to discuss about the future of Europe together, but it has been discussed many years ago in Aspen, Colorado, and I think it's a good sign. I have a wish, I have a dream, and I talked to Walter Isaacson and to the Aspen Ideas Festival team many times about Aspen Ideas Festival. I really would like that the Europe will be more present next year, not only with Aspen France, but also with our friends in Italy, with Aspen Italy, Aspen in Romania. We have one member of Aspen Italia in the panel tonight, and also with Aspen Berlin. And I'm sure that we will be able to have more discussion and more interest on Europe within the Aspen Ideas Festival. So I have been too long, and I would like to thank all of you, and especially Jean-François Richard. He's a member of Aspen France, and he has accepted to moderate this panel. He has been the former vice president of the World Bank in Europe, in Paris. And thank you very much, Jean-François, to accept to moderate this panel. So I have been too long. I do hope a nice and stimulating discussion on Europe with all of you. And thank you for your participation.
Yeah, actually, I'm a stand-in moderator. I'm replacing Jean-Christophe Basse, who missed his airplane or something like that. And I'm... I'm warning you, this is a 100% jet lag panel. It's not about old and new Europe. We decided that was a stupid title. And we're going to stick to Europe and the transatlantic relationship. And when I thought about what I would say to introduce the topic, I thought that there are two entirely different pictures of Europe that you can form. One picture is Europe as a declining region and as an increasingly powerless player. That picture describes the economy of Europe as one that is plagued by a problem of aging, with soon only two workers per retiree. It's an area that lacks economic dynamism, with only a handful of countries that are very competitive, very few world-class universities. And it's a Europe whose share of world GDP, which is currently 25%, will go down to something like 12% by 2050. That same picture describes the economic and social model that Europe is so proud of as one that produces unemployment and that produces a government that weighs between 45 and 50% of GDP. So that's the bad story on the economy. On foreign affairs, it describes the Europe that has a limited role in the world, that has a very fragmented foreign affairs setup, and that is not even capable of handling the foreign affairs issues in its neighborhood areas of the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and the Balkans. It's also a Europe that has put itself at the mercy of Russia in terms of energy dependence, and a Europe that has still that is still struggling with its own constitution. It's now trying in the form of a mini treaty, and there's still resistances from inside, including from two Polish brothers. Third point on the on this bad rap is the transatlantic partner role of Europe is a fading one, and one where in the future you'll have this giant China, India, and US, each having almost 20% of world GDP, with a tiny Europe in between. And it's a Europe that would have a hard time fielding more than 30,000 troops at this time anywhere into the world, and which has a lot of small, technically obsolete armies. So this is the negative view. Then you have a positive view, which is Europe as a role model. On the economy there, you would say that Europe is the country, is the region that has the world's best knowledge-based economies. Ireland, Finland, Denmark, Estonia, Sweden, they're actually champions of advanced competitiveness. They have fantastic education systems, they have very high-tech economies, and they're real models. Europe is a clear leader in telecoms and pharmaceutics. Last week, there was an air show in Le Bourget, and Airbus sold three times more airplanes than Boeing. And there are some very interesting systems like the Flexi Security model in Denmark, which has both flexible labor market and social security combined. On the foreign affairs side, the positive view would say that Europe has the wiser, more subtle diplomacy, that it's been the main force behind the survival of the world's very precious multilateral system, that the EU itself, the European Union, is a sort of model of the sort of global governance the world should have if it was an ideal world, and that it has been a model of achieving peace through enlargement and association effects, that Europe has been the leader on the environment and by a long mile, and that Europe accounts for 60% of official development assistance when it actually accounts for only 25% of GDP in the world. And it would say that as a transatlantic partner, Europe remains a loyal and staid transatlantic partner to the US no matter what happens, and that it upholds the moral reputation of the West that the alliance used to stand for. And that in terms of peacekeeping, Europe is actually quite effective, even if it's low-key. So you have these two views, and I will ask my three panelists to answer three questions. The first question is Europe at 50 years old, which is what we have celebrated very recently. What are the achievements of Europe? Then Europe at 100 years old, 50 years from now, which has to do with the challenges Europe faces. And finally, what about the transatlantic relationships? Can we do better? Can we rebuild it? Does it need rebuilding and so forth? Those are the three questions. And as they answer these questions, I hope they will is a vote for the declining Europe view or the role model view. We'll see where they come out. The first speaker will be Ulrike Gero, who is a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund, and who is a specialist precisely of the transatlantic relationship and of European issues. She's often on TV. Then we have Professor Daniel Dayanu, who used to be finance minister of Romania in 97-98, and is now a professor of economics at the School of Political and Administrative Studies in Bucharest. Then we have Philippe Kela, who went through a very interesting career, both in the private sector and in the civil service of France, and is now running Euronews, which is a TV system, a news TV system that is beating even CNN in Europe. That's how successful it is. And finally, Nicholas Dungan, who, like me, is a reformed investment banker and who is now the president of the French-American Foundation. He will be a discussant, so he'll get three more minutes than the others. The others will get just 7 minutes flat. Ulrike, your turn.
My turn. So first, let me thank you all that I have the occasion to be here. It's my first time in Aspen. I need to say it's gorgeous. It's over exceeding everything I would have expected. And it's my pleasure to be here to talk on Europe. If I may add one sentence on the presentation, I am working for the German Marshall Fund for the, of the United States, but I will, and I say this because it will be important for the way I will talk of Europe. I will be joining the newly to be created Council, European Council on Foreign Relations, which is going to be launched in September. And because I will be working for the European Council on Foreign Relations, you apologize that I will take the role model vision of Europe and for Europe, just because this is what I will be paid for. But not only this is what I will be paid for, I also believe it. And so the three questions, I need to be very short. Therefore, I will also need to be probably very provocative, but this is, I guess, the game here on this panel. The achievements of Europe. I guess in the words of Bush Senior, the achievements of Europe are Europe whole and free. Europe is whole and free, which is whatever has been in the U.S. interest since 50 years. You spent emotions, politics, financial aid to get there. We are there. I think that's a brilliant achievement. It's the achievement we should all be proud of, Europeans, Americans, and I think that is something that this continent has been not for 500 years or so in the kind of recent history. It's peaceful, it's united, and we transformed the East. We took 12 countries into the European Union. We have a huge success story to tell about the transformation process in the outreach, in the Eastern outreach of the European Union. Peaceful transformation. We have the euro. We have an established world currency, which, by the way, is exceeding the dollar in many respects. It has more than 35% of currency world reserves now, so it's a successful currency. It's only 5 years old, and if you can forecast, it's probably also going to last and to be a successful currency that is on the market. And we now have a constitution. I say quote-unquote a constitution. Perhaps some of you followed the last June Council just a week ago. And basically, we do no longer call it constitution, but basically we save the essential elements of the constitutional draft treaty. So I don't know who of you have children, and many of you may have read Harry Potter, but in Harry Potter there's this person of Voldemort, which is the person you don't should say that you shouldn't say the name of. So I guess what we did with the European constitution is in some way that we saved the constitution. We should not say the word because it has been scary to some Dutch people and some French people. So we rather go back to some technical language, but we do have essentials that will have an impact on institutional reform, how the EU will work, how it is efficient, and I think that's a lasting treaty that will also make the external representation of the European Union much better than it has been. Second point, challenges. Yes, there are a couple of challenges on the economic side, and yes, there's matters of democracy and migration, but migration demographies are matters for the whole world. It's not only a European problem. I mean, it's an American problem. It's an Asian problem. We tend to think that China is also young and also kind of dynamic, but in 2030, forecasts say that two-thirds of the Chinese population will be older than 70 years. So, I mean, demography is a European problem, but it's a worldwide problem. I wouldn't say that this is a negative impact only for Europe. On the economic side, at least as if you look on Germany and other of the small economies, Dutch, the Netherlands, Ireland, and so on and so forth, these economies are well performing. And Germany used the transition to the euro, basically, to do a lot of structural reforms, which now pay off. And the Germany economy is on track to get better. And the last kind of sick child in Europe is perhaps France, and we may see perhaps with Sarkozy some reforms here. I think in terms of challenges, I would rather like to talk about the external challenges of the European Union. In one sentence, I think the challenge of the European Union is to shift it from a domestic undertaking towards an global actor in the world role. We have been accustomed that Europe is basically a single market, a euro, agricultural policy, and many things that work on redistribution and that are kind of domestic politics. What needs to be done over the next 10 and 15 years and where Europe has to prove that it is a world player is to get out to the world, take over responsibility, and prove that it gets its act together, can take over responsibility in its neighborhood, in the Middle East, in Africa, and elsewhere in the world. And I think to shift the European Union from domestic action to external action is the biggest challenge ahead. I'm not saying that this is easy. It will be hard work. It will also be hard work to convince our citizens that this is the duty of the European Union just because there are costs at stake. Of course, nothing is for free. And if you want to kind of spread peace or do transformation, these the cost-effect policies. But that's the challenge of the European Union. I'm rather confident that we will have the opportunity to fix the Balkans, to bring peace to the Balkans, and ultimately take the Balkan countries into the European Union. The more important question, and I would also overstate that argument, it's probably the most important question in terms of foreign policy for the 21st century, which is that Turkey joins the European Union. Why? Not only because Europe, for itself and its own interest, needs to get a geostrategic perspective. And Turkey, as you know, is in a very complex neighborhood, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and so on and so forth. But more important than that, to prove Huntington wrong, which is that the 21st century is about the West against Islam, European Union is probably the only political entity that can give an arm to the Muslim world on earth. I think that the world is looking on Europe to make that pass and that step and to show that Muslims per se or that Islam per se is able to be governed on rule of law basis, human rights, and so on and so forth. I think that's a crucial question. It's a crucial question that will determine how the world will see the European Union and how we can prove that the European Union is not a Christian club, but an outreaching political entity based on rules of law, humanity, human rights, and so on and so forth. I consider that being one of the most important questions for the 21st century in terms of foreign policy. Third question, EU-United States relationships. That's a very complicated one, and I, since I need to be short, I perhaps overstate my argument, so I, in a way, I apologize up front on this. I think we are in a very problematical setting between Europe and the United States, and one of the reasons I would point out is that we tend to look to the past to fix the future. We have a discourse that many times goes on, if only times were before 89, or if only we could repoliticize NATO, or if only that could happen then. I think we have both, US and European Union, not yet understood to which extent all parameters of international relations have changed since 89/9/11. I'm saying this also because I look at the young people in Europe. If you poll young people in Europe, and I take my sons first, 14 and 16 years old, they would not even know what NATO is, just because NATO in their lifetime has never had an important role. So all parameters and references in their mindset have changed. To give you another polling data that my institute has put on the table a couple of months ago, if you measure sympathy curves of Europeans/Germans on a scale from 0 to 100, what is the sympathy for any given country, Israel, Russia, or USA, and so on and so forth, you get 51% sympathy from Germans for the United States and 50 for Russia. That tells you something, unfortunately, about how much your peace dividend and 50 years of engagement that you had for Germany is gone. But my kids do no longer know that their grandfather, which is my father, received the candies from the GA in 49. So I'm saying that just to say how much the extent of parameters and references have changed to make the world of the future, and we won't be able to do that with the past and the systems of the past. My point is here that I feel that in the US-EU discourse, there's too much focus on NATO, not yet enough focus on EU-US relationships and how can they be shaped in the future. I'm saying that because I don't want to be disconstructive, nor do I want to say that NATO is obsolete. I only want to make the point that NATO first do no longer cover the content of the transatlantic issues we have to cope. Not as NATO involved, not involved in Iran, Iraq, Chinese arms embargo, everything that bothers us between the US and the European Union. It's not on the NATO agenda per se. And second, NATO is an institution which, by the functioning of the institutions, the Europeans cannot voice difference. We have seen that very unfortunately. You are with us or against that. That was Rumsfeld, and this was not to our pleasure. If we want a system in which we can be your friend, but say sometimes that we see the world a little bit differently, we need other institutions that can cope with the fact that we want to be your friend, but we want to voice difference. And NATO does not allow that institutionally. So therefore, my pledge or my argument is that NATO can no longer carry transatlantic relations, also because they are broader, and the overarching overarching agenda of G8, climate protection, so on and so forth, is not a NATO agenda. We need to constructively think about the future, how we reorganize also in institutional terms EU-US relationship. And the argument of the United States, which I hear many times in Washington, which is that we need the capitals, we need London, Brussels, of course you need the capitals, no point. The problem is, I think there's a reciprocal dynamic, and the more you basically strengthen the European Union, the more you will get out of it. What I'm saying here is that probably the European Union as a political entity that can best fix the U.S. interest on the European continent, as there are stability, Ukraine, Turkey, all the things you want to see, Balkan, peaceful, and so on and so forth, the solutions won't come from London nor from Paris. They will come from the European Union, and this is why the U.S. should rethink its approach to basically handle the European Union as a political entity. Last sentence here. There is a U.S. ambivalence, which is kind of give us the reality, and we can cope with that. I mean, you hear many times in Washington, if only we had the European phone number, or if only things were this and that. There's not one U.S. phone number neither. You know, on crises like Iraq, there were at least three or four phone numbers relevant in Washington, so there's not one phone number in the European Union. My point here is there's a little kind of ambivalence in the saying that if you... fix your reality, then we are happy with that. But the moment we did the euro, there were some feelings here. You know, there is a little bit kind of competition. So I guess my point is that I'm very unhappy most of the time, to quote Mr. Rumsfeld. But in one thing that he has on his website, he was pretty clear, which is A people choose A people and B people choose C people. And my point here is that many times in the past years, I personally felt that the U.S. were more B looking for C than an A looking for an A. And if we want to be the West, quote unquote, to have an important role in the world, I think the U.S. should go for an A and make Europe, or help Europe to be an A, because this is what you did for 50 years. Last sentence, whatever we do, the West, US, Europe, united or not united, I think we both, Europe and the United States, should be much more modest than we have been, also in terms of the parameters of the world that change. One figure is that in 2050, US and EU population combined will make only 7% of world population. Whatever we do, together or not, combined or not, we should be much more modest and give much more space to the other peoples on Earth. I think that's the lesson we both have to learn, and that constructively. Thank you.
Well, that was 10 minutes, but there was a lot of stuff in there. So. And it was inspirational at the end. So, Professor Dayanu, 7 minutes. You can only go over if you're inspirational at the end.
And creativity and imagination. Knowledge is not enough, as someone this morning has said. I'm not going to deal with accomplishments, because in my view, this already has become platitudes. Economic prosperity, democracy. Here, I would highlight that democracy is not of long vintage in Europe, if we think about the interwar period. So one has to be more humble when extolling the credentials of democracy on the European continent, and be more cautious about what's lying ahead. I'll try rather to focus on the wave of Europe pessimism in Europe. I'm not using this binary logic. It's either great, it's either a very shabby state of affairs. I think that one can use both intellectual matrices. What I think is greatly underestimated by people in Europe, but also in the United States, is that there is a hell of a difference between Europe pessimism and its roots nowadays, and Europe pessimism, for example, a few decades ago, when Sylvain Schreiber, a famous French essayist, wrote The American Challenge. The current roots of Europe pessimism are related to several intricately interlinked forces at work, which are very hard to deal with. One is complexity. Europe, the club, is so large nowadays. People who are well attuned to what organizational theory means and how tough it is to run a large organization, understand that the manageability of such a great, rapidly increasing organization is exceeding the abilities of politicians who clearly are not high-caliber statesmen and high-caliber politicians. And that's also a problem. Leadership is statesmanship. Secondly, the pressure of globalization. On one hand, they have infringed on traditional prerogatives and instruments of economic policymaking in Europe. And the club is trying to substitute the logic of the club for the weaknesses of national policymaking. But that's ironic, because this is happening, or it's been happening in recent years, at a time of a resurrection of nationalism, because national governments see that frequently it doesn't work. The club doesn't work effectively when it comes to energy policy, when it comes to foreign policy in fundamental ways, when it comes to security policy, and they get back to traditional ways of policymaking. And this is really bad for. On the other hand, one could argue nationalism is on the rise throughout the world. It's not simply a European phenomenon. There is also demographics. I would not be so, I part company here with Ulrike. I think it's different. It is something for a society to be aging when the welfare state is so overbloated as in Europe. Asian societies do not have such a welfare state, so it's much easier to cope with the pressures of globalization. So downsizing the welfare state is a must. How we do it, that's also very tricky, because one has to do it at a time of rapidly rising income inequality, at a time of widespread cynicism, with CEOs who get a lot of money for a poor performance of companies. So we come to the issues of moral values, ethics, how politicians relate to their electorates when there is clear a deficit of democracy. There is a deficit of democracy when we talk about the pan-European policymaking, but there is also a deficit of democracy when we talk about national policymaking. So these are very structural. There are also weaknesses which are coming on different routes. They are related to the emergence of the new giants, China, India, and that's also something which is quite tremendously different of a few decades ago. China could very easily turn to the UK of 200 years ago, and we cannot compete. I'm talking on behalf, in a humble way, on behalf of low-wage economies in Europe. And we realize increasingly that we cannot compete against the Chinese, the Indians. They use the new information and communication technology in a superb ways. They produce 500,000 of engineers per year. Here in the United States, the production of engineers is about 50 or 60,000. So how can we compete with those guys if we rely on MBA degrees or on law degrees? So these are real issues, very hard to deal with them. Global change, the curse of dealing with rapidly diminishing non-renewable resources, and in my view, future conflicts are going to be related to the control of not only oil and gas, but also drinking water. The specter, just remember the Club of Rome report a few decades ago. Some highly optimistic guy said it's a crazy report, it's not true, and now we realize how myopic and stupid many of us have been over the years. So how can we deal with this? Because the international architecture is quite in disarray. We have to reinvent the IMF and the World Bank, but not only. Ulrike has been talking about NATO, but NATO is not, it's only a part of the international architecture, maybe not the most important. So how can we reinvent it unless we engage China and India? We cannot just send instructions to the rest of the world. We cannot think about reinventing the international architecture when our approaches are Eurocentric or American-centric. Let me just say a few words on the transatlantic relationship. And I would paraphrase this, Madame Albright, when she said that the United States is the indispensable nation. I say, this relationship could turn into an indispensable relationship. But for that to happen, there should be much more intellectual and operational empathy between people in Washington or the elites in Washington and the elites in Europe. And this is not clear that this is not the predicament. It cannot be predetermined in a mechanical way. So we might share common values, but we might not share similar approaches to dealing with various issues around the world, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's engaging China, or dealing with Iran, so on and so on. So I'm pretty subdued. I think Europe could have a better future. In relative terms, it's going not to decay, but it's going to decline. The same could happen with the United States. And the problem is that decline in relative terms should not be accompanied by decline in absolute terms. Because if we are going to experience decline in absolute terms, we're going to have social fractures. It is excluded or the people who are not enfranchised, the people who are outside the social mainstream, the political mainstream, they could break down our societies in the decades ahead. But one has to stay optimistic. One has to be open-minded. One has to shun fundamentalism, whether in economic policy making or whether in foreign policy. And we have a few blatant examples of how damaging fundamentalism can be. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel, and thanks for staying within the limits of time. Philippe from
Jean-François.
Media world.
Considering the general attitude to Europe, I'm not ranging into the Eurosceptic, but rather into the Euro-optimist, not only because I feel so, but also because my company consists of making an European news channel with several journalists from many countries. And so we all at Euronews represent in some way the voice of Europe. So we like to have an optimistic view of Europe, of course. In terms of achievements, I would like to play the role of the citizen, of the European citizen. What does the European citizen see exactly from the achievements of Europe? First of all, he sees what the former prime minister called that Europe is a space of peace ruled by law. It's not magnificent as an idea, but at least it's something. We have peace, we have laws. It's not nothing, and it applies in a very large territory now. So I think it is an achievement, a major achievement. In some way, Europe is, for the first time in history, a Pacific empire, which is expanding, and everybody wants to be part of Europe, so it's amazing, but it's so. And I don't know where it will finish, but of course, it can be considered as a major achievement that everybody wants to be member of Europe. Secondly, in the economic field, we now have a common market for 40 years now. It's common sense to say that, but this common market means something to the people, of course. They can buy goods anywhere in Europe. It's more or less the same price everywhere in Europe, so it's something which is a major achievement. And the third thing is maybe less common to you, it's that we have some kind of Europe à la carte, because in some fields of European achievements, it doesn't apply to all Europe, but only to a selected number of countries. The most well-known, of course, is the euro, the European currency, which applies only to 13 countries. Less known is the Schengen Agreement, which is a free circulation agreement between 13 countries. It is the same number, but not the same countries, by the way, where you don't need you can travel without passport. So it's if you combine the fact that you can travel in a country where you can have the euro and it is a Schengen country, it means that it is like going to the next door, to the neighbor next door. You know, when I personally go from Paris to Madrid or to Rome or to Berlin, I don't need to take other currency to change, and I don't need to take my passport. So it's like going from Aspen to Denver or to New York. So it's a major achievement. And less known as well for the students, we have in Europe a program named Erasmus, which is the name of a philosopher of the 13th century, a Dutch philosopher, by the way. And the Erasmus program is a frame whereby all the students can go across Europe and continue their studies in other universities, and the degrees they can gain are recognized in their home country, so that when they come back, the degrees are recognized. So it's a major achievement as well. Another a la carte program, which is very well known from you, is Airbus. Airbus is not a pan-European program. There is a selected number of countries, but it's a major achievement as well. You will accept that. So this is the achievements. What are the challenges for the layman in the street again? First of all, the enlargement of Europe is perceived for many Europeans still more as a challenge than as an achievement. Because even if we have so many countries now in Europe, many Europeans think that it's not very good in their day-to-day life. They resent it as some kind of competition from other countries, low-wage countries, but nevertheless, we have so many industries which have been delocalized from the Western Europe to Eastern Europe, which is good for Eastern Europe, but not so good for Western Europe, of course. So many Western citizens don't really understand and accept this situation. So it's still a challenge for the government to make that accept by the population. And there is a fear also that this misunderstanding may create some rise of nationalism again. It was mentioned by Daniel before, but nationalism becomes again an issue in Europe. I hope not like in the 30s, of course, because now we are a peaceful continent. But nevertheless, there are some signs of nationalism across Europe, and I must say that the media are not innocent in this field. Many media raise, I would say, the ire of nationals against neighboring countries, not to mention for the time being between the Poles and the Germans, for instance, which is not reasonable at all and should be stopped. But it's still a challenge to stop that. A challenge which is a lasting challenge in Europe is very simply the attitude of the United Kingdom. Is the United Kingdom a European country? It is debatable. The attitude in the recent negotiation for the treaty was clearly nearly anti-European. The fact that they didn't even accept the symbols of Europe, the flag, the hymn, simple things which any other European accepts, is really mean, very mean. And frankly speaking, it's difficult to understand where UK is going in Europe. Other challenges are more economic, on the economic side. Unemployment is an issue. The average rate in Europe is 8%, which is far too high. And innovation is also an issue. We don't innovate enough. We need to have more researchers, more creative industries, and especially in the new age of the internet, we don't have enough new creative companies. Now, about the US-Europe relationship, 3 points. First of all, is US a threat or a protection for Europe? What I mean is that US presents themselves as a protection, and many countries in Europe would think that the US are protecting themselves because of the Cold War, because of the fact that thanks to the Cold War, the Americans won the war against the Russians, and now the eastern part of Europe could reintegrate Europe. But the attitude of the US in the Middle East is perceived as a threat to Europe because it's so aggressive that many Europeans think they are more at threat because of this attitude as they were if Americans had another attitude, more diplomatic. The second point is globalization. The US are very much promoting globalization of trade, very much promoting the entry of new countries in the WTO. Is it really reasonable to have China in the WTO? Is it reasonable to have a dictator, to have non-democratic countries in the WTO? Countries where we know that trade unions are not allowed, that opposition is not allowed, there are no democratic elections. And in addition of that, we just discovered in China that slavery exists. Is it reasonable to have such countries in the WTO? Question mark. Last question mark for Europeans is are the American investment funds and pension funds going to take over all the European industry? The recent merge between the NYSE and Euronext, the two stock exchange, is very emblematic. Is it a partnership or is it a takeover? We don't know yet. We'll see. But it applies to all European industry. Is it going to be taken over by American interests? We don't know. So these are some question marks also in European minds. Thank you.
Niklas, your turn.
Thank you.
Try to stay to 7-8 minutes because we want some questions.
Yes, definitely. This is a difficult role because the discussant is meant to both critique the earlier presentations and at least offer a few thoughts of his own. I'm going to try to do that as swiftly as I can. The other thing is that you may wonder whether I am speaking sometimes as a European and sometimes as an American, and as president of the French American Foundation, my job is to do both. So the answer to the question is yes, I am speaking as both. I want to take on the issues to some extent in the order in which they were raised and dealt with. Europe's accomplishments, it is simply not understood in the European Union or in the United States what an accomplishment Europe is. If you look at the CIA fact book, it will tell you that the creation of the European Union is an accomplishment unparalleled in human history. The closest parallel you could possibly find is the alliance of Uri, Schwyz, and Unterwald in 1291 when they decided to form the Swiss Confederation. And it took almost 1,000 years after that, and in 50 years, Europe has beaten swords into plowshares. So Europe whole and free, a Europe as a zone of peace and justice, is one of the most amazing accomplishments in the history of humanity. It can handle complexity, in my view. I think that Europe is very good at doing big things that take a long time, a lot of thought and investment. What it isn't is nimble. But putting the euro in place, and putting the euro in place a year before the millennium bug was supposed to hit, without a single hitch, with all the coins, all the banknotes, agreement on everything, delivered on time everywhere, I would say that that is not a characteristic that we would find in the typical Anglo-Saxon countries, Britain or the United States, which are not as good as Europe at doing big things that require long-term investment and a long-term vision and a huge amount of cooperation. I wonder also whether it isn't true that the new European values of shared sovereignty, of management of resources as scarce resources, of a feeling that the individual has a duty to society and vice versa, are not actually the kinds of values that we are going to need to see emphasized in the 21st century, rather than the traditional Jacksonian American values of individualism, nationalism, not giving up sovereignty, the management of resources as if they are abundant and will last forever. Europe clearly has considerable soft power. And I think that brings us to the second issue, which is the one of European enlargement. Metternich said Asia begins at the Landstrasse, and that was at the point when the Landstrasse was the easternmost street in Vienna. And the fact is that the Ottoman Empire and is the area which has most resisted the Wilsonian vision of self-determination. Almost all of Austria-Hungary has now been incorporated into the European Union. The countries that remain are basically from the Ottoman Empire. And in fact, it's very difficult to see how Turkey fits in the European Union, in my opinion. Geopolitically, it makes total sense for Turkey to be part of NATO. And indeed, Turkey was one of the three NATO countries that had a direct border with the Soviet Union, along with Norway and the United States. But the fact is, the European Union is a community. It is not an alliance. And as a result, Europe does need borders, as President Sarkozy has said. However, because Europe has soft power, because it is big and good at doing complex things over a long period of time, Europe can use its attractiveness in what, along the Mediterranean littoral, and through the Levant. And indeed, there exists today something which is not very well known either in Europe or in the US, called the European Union Friendship Zone. Turkey is already a part of that. So is the Palestinian Authority. So is Israel. And so are all the countries, with the possible exception of Libya, I'm not sure, along the Mediterranean shore. So I think that the soft power, in terms of what Orica was talking about and this question of European expansion, the soft power can be used in a very European way, and the hard power may just have to wait. One of the messages that you heard from everybody was that we need to look to the future. And the fact is that we cannot rest our laurels on our European and American Enlightenment ideals. We need to reunite with those, we need to rekindle those, but we cannot constantly go back, as I did on the 6th of June this year, to the Normandy beaches and say, this is what we are all about. We have to be about something in the future. We have to exercise leadership together in the 21st century. In his doctoral thesis, which was about the Congress of Vienna, Henry Kissinger says that had Metternich lived 50 years earlier, he would still have been a conservative, but he would not have had to write pedantic disquisitions about the nature of conservatism. And we are in the Western Alliance in Metternich's position today. 50 years ago, every school child in Western Europe and in North America knew that the Atlantic Alliance was the guarantor of individual freedom, world peace, and the safeguarding of the values of Western civilization. That is absolutely not clear today, as you were saying. In order to reaffirm our common values, we need to know what they are. And in actual fact, there's only one. And that is a common value that both unites us and distinguishes us from everybody else without getting into a Huntington-esque clash of civilizations. The fact is that we in the West have chosen to try to regulate our societies by trying to find, by seeking the appropriate balance between personal freedom and the public good, to the exclusion of every other factor, whether you're Shia and I'm Sunni, where you and I stand in the Chinese Communist Party hierarchy, whether your Bolivian grandfather, you know, burned down the village that my Bolivian grandfather lived in, to the exclusion of every other factor. Once we restate those values, realize what they are, then we have to look at the problems of the 21st century, which are completely different than what our Enlightenment ideals prepared us for or what the Normandy beaches prepared us for. We need to craft a new future together with Western leadership based on those values. And the fact is that we can do it. Japan is now a Western country. India could become a Western country tomorrow if we say that being a Western country means adopting that shared value that we have. And the three main challenges, and I will speed up a little bit on this because we could go into a great deal of complexity, but maybe we want to do that during the questions. It seems to me that the three main challenges for the West in the 21st century are citizenship, sustainability, and security. And they are all different than they were in the 20th century. Briefly, citizenship, what does it mean to be a citizen in a globalized world? And beyond immigration and integration, what do we want for our societies? We need to realize that in the 21st century, the quality of our societies will be a determining factor in the power of our countries. So if we don't have people who get health care, if we don't have people who get education, and if we don't have a sense of shared responsibility between individuals and societies, the countries, the West, will suffer. Secondly, sustainability. Ecological sustainability is extremely important, but so is energy independence, and so is economic sustainability. Europe is very good at infrastructure. France is very good at water and nuclear energy. America can learn from Europe on those things. Europe needs to, and Europe needs to learn from the United States on such things as entrepreneurship and the path to market for fundamental research, where the U.S. is streets ahead of anybody else in the world. And that's an incredibly key factor in economic sustainability. Lastly, in security, we need to choose our battles and fight them well. And this is where both the humility but also the specialization of what we do comes into play. We need to choose issues which we believe to be crucial to international relations, and we need to make policy together. And that is precisely what France, Germany, Britain, and the United States, and surprisingly Britain, and the United States have been doing on Iran. And then that policy gets negotiated with Russia and with China. And that has been successful. And as long as there are no wild cards, it will continue to be successful. So restate our values, identify the problems, and then in order to approach those problems, we need an efficient Europe. And that is going to mean a Europe of circles, a Europe where some countries do some things and a broader number do other things. As long as Britain is associated with the European Union, there will be no political Europe. So, and it is inside the European Union, and it's there to stay for a long time. It's a very disruptive influence, but it's one that can't be got rid of. Consequently, a series of specializations within Europe is required. On the other side, America needs to be more imaginative, more open to models from other places, and it needs to look at problems not as American problems, but as issues where it may have a stake or it may not. But rather than saying, what can America learn from Dubai? Let's say, what's going on in Dubai? What is America's role in terms of Iran? It should be, what does the West as a whole need in terms of Iran, and what can America contribute? And I think the humility plays, therefore, both within the alliance as well as outside. So to conclude, I would say that we need to reunite with the concept of responsibility. When people talk about lack of leadership since the end of the Cold War, and there has been a significant lack of leadership since the end of the Cold War, that is compared to the end of the Second World War. And what we found was that the greatest generation was prepared to accept responsibilities that were absolutely unheard of, and they resulted in the building of the European Union, the Marshall Plan, NATO, and Western victory in the Cold War. And the consequence of power and responsibility at the state level is also that we need to reunite with the concept of freedom and responsibility at the individual level. The two are one and the same thing, one at the level of the citizen, one at the level of the polity. So quite frankly, in terms of how will we do and where we're going to be in Europe and in the transatlantic relationship in the next 50 years, we need to look at ourselves and we need to work on ourselves first and foremost.
I think we'll open for questions, and we'll take two questions at once.
Yeah, two by two, and if you can present yourself, it would be great. So one microphone over there, one question, please.
And also tell us to whom you're addressing the question among the panelists.
My name is Doug Lawrence, J.P. Morgan, to the gentleman from Euronews and the gentleman from the Franco-American Association or Foundation. Can you explain the last election in France? I mean, I don't get it.
I didn't hear the question.
Can you explain the Sarkozy-Ségolène election in France? And then what does Sarkozy's election mean, portend for change in the direction of Europe at all?
You want me to start? You want to start?
I can start if you like.
Good.
I think...
One more. My question's a little further afield. I'd like to ask a bottom line question. At what point would Europe initiate military action to prevent Iran from possessing nuclear weapons? At what point would Europe draw a line in the sand?
I answer the first question.
You do the first. The second one I'll think about.
The second one is.
You want to take the second one? Okay, you game.
Mr. Sarkozy is won the election by large, as you know, and I think first of all, with the other candidates, it's a new generation coming up, in their 50s, no longer in their 70s. By the way, after this election, 20 million Frenchmen felt themselves older because they were younger than the former president, and now they are older than the present president. So, but to be frank, I think Mr. Sarkozy explained exactly what he what he's supposed to do. So it's very clear that he's going to open the labor market, to improve the quality of the research and the universities. He's going to, also to have a foreign policy which will be more balanced between the Arab world and Israel, probably, and more open to the U.S., I think, also. And he's been very efficient within the last month in contributing heavily, I think, in helping Mrs. Merkel, the German Chancellor, to find an agreement with the 26 other countries for the reform treaty, which is the new name of the
constitution.
Of the late constitutional treaty. So I don't know what we can see, what we can say else. Maybe
let me add one or two quick things. First of all, what was the election about? It was actually about what the French call le débat d'idées. It was an election about ideas and about a model of society. And Sarkozy was offering a traditionalist model of society, but saying we need reform, and we need reform from a strong leader. Ségolène Royal was a kind of postmodern vision of society, which was, I'll listen to you, you tell me what you want, and then I'll see to it that it's implemented. The French made a clear choice. 53 to 47 is a pretty big gap. And at 85% voter turnout, which, by the way, is something that you cannot have if you have an electoral college that has a winner-take-all system state by state. The only reason the turnout, if you had a system here like you have in France where everybody's vote counts the same, you could have 85% turnout in the United States. I'm convinced it's a structural thing and it's not actually about voter apathy. That's an aside. What does Sarkozy's election mean for Europe? Real reinvigoration. And for the United States, there has never been a team in the Élysée Palace or in the ministries that is more transatlantically oriented and understands the United States better than this one. Bernard Kouchner, the founder of Médecins Sans Frontières, is the foreign minister. Jean-David Lévite, who was ambassador to the United States, immediately went back and became the foreign policy and national security advisor. There are a number of former French American Foundation young leaders who are members of the cabinet, and these are people who've got significant exposure to the U.S. And the man who has just been named ambassador to the United States was the chief of staff to the last three foreign ministers. This is like taking Nick Burns and making him ambassador to France. You can't get any higher than that as a statement of, it's kind of what the U.S. has traditionally done with its ambassadors to Japan, as a statement of respect. But that is also the team that lived through the 2003 to 2005 crisis. And they know that the worst thing that can happen to European statesmen in the 21st century is to have to answer the question not who lost China or who lost Russia, but who lost America. And what they are determined to do is to put together an efficient Europe and make sure that it comes and becomes the indispensable ally to the Americans. And that actually segues into your Iranian question, which is that I believe that the issue is not about Mars and Venus, and I don't think it's about one side being for or against the use of force. I don't think that there is a glimmer of daylight between the French and the Americans, and I don't think there's very much of a glimmer of daylight between the Germans and the Brits on the assessment of the reality of the threat of Iran possessing nuclear weapons. I wrote a piece in the International Herald Tribune called Iran, It Could Be the Anti-Iraq. I think that the threat assessment is very similar, and I think the use of force, the day that Europe will sign up for the use of force will be the day that all four of those countries jointly conclude that force is the only thing that will work. At the moment, they still want to tighten the sanctions. Let me say something else about this, which is very important with respect to Russia and China. The Russians don't necessarily want to see a solution to this problem. They have much more control over this issue if it is kept within the Security Council. They can continue to trade. They got a carve-out on the last set of sanctions. They can continue to trade, and they can continue to supply nuclear technology to the Iranians. If they didn't do that, if they weren't in that position, then Westinghouse or Areva or Siemens would be the supplier, and the Russians would be out those contracts. So from the Russian standpoint, there's an economic interest in keeping this thing kind of alive but well-managed and not having the permanent Security Council members plus Germany too angry at them. From China's standpoint, we know that China is implementing a very long-term strategic energy policy, and clearly, from China's standpoint, having Iran as an energy supplier, it's has the largest natural gas reserves in the world, is something that is in China's interest. So in my opinion, the only way that we in the West can be successful is to make sure that on a spectrum from negotiate forever to use force now, that all four of us, the United States, Britain, France, and Germany, are determined to do the same thing. And right now there seems to be, inshallah, touch wood, there seems to be complete unity amongst those four on what our policy should be, and I expect that will continue.
You want?
If I may, as a European, I would like to give you other thoughts, say. I think the dossier on Iran is probably the most concerning we have. And the question to your answer is kind of, when is the point where the Europeans would take? There is no point. No point I would be able to tell you. I would bet that the French, the Brits, and the Germans don't have a point, and I would bet that Washington does not have a point. Because what we are facing is basically a lose-lose situation. Either we are negotiating, hoping, trying to make Iran implode from the interior, and we may be betrayed, and they go for the nukes, and they will have it ultimately in 2 or 3 or 4 years. Or we bomb Iran, and then we are spoiled. The worldwide recognition, everything that this country stands for, I think is gone. I mean, the public diplomacy of the U.S. is below 10%, not only in the Middle East, but also in Europe. It's not even better. The moment that the learning curve of Iraq is gone, and there's the kind of same thing in Iran, let alone all the questions kind of, is it militarily doable, under which prices, who sends the troops, you, Israel, who goes first? I mean, there are thousands of military questions that even the Pentagon is not able to give clear answers as of today. So the question is not when are the Europeans ready to go with you to strike. The question is Washington decided to strike, and what are your domino effect scenarios? What is the reflex from Iran if you strike? I mean, they would probably not bomb Europe. They will probably close the Strait of Hormuz, shut down European energy streets, go to Saudi Arabia, and so on and so forth. So I think that this country knows perfectly that the crisis scenario of consequences, if you strike, are so kind of worse that you should think twice, 3, 4, 5 times to go for a strike. So the question is not when will Europe be ready. I think that in this scenario, that's my personal opinion, but I'd like to share with you at least a couple of thoughts that you would hear in Europe, and I would argue you don't hear them that often in the United States, which are the TNP is anyway dead, the Treaty on Non-Proliferation, the U.S. policy towards India, many other countries, Pakistan, and so on and so forth, your policy, the U.S. policy towards North Korea, who showed perfectly that the country is taken basically for serious when it gets nuclear bombs. I mean, there are a couple of arguments that make the point that the Treaty of Non-Proliferation is already exploded. That can be discussed. The other question is then, what about Iran and how to cope with it? I mean, I would first make the point that the EU has done a good job with the big three, that the US has done a good job in going into this negotiation. I would also there is more to explore, much more on the terms of diplomacy. I would argue that the international community is not so much united, because I would bet that neither Russia nor China would go for sanctions, so that the other kind of story that we can do at the United Nations story may be a failure, as Iraq has been a failure. And if ever there's an Israel-US attack alone, how that would impact on global world affairs, I'm not so sure. So the only thing I would like to say is cool. What I sense is there's sort of domestic overheating in this debate in this country, if I compare it to European debates on this. What experts tell you is, even if it sounds silly, we have time. Iran is not ready to have the full cycle before 2 or 3 years. We should take this time to think. That is my pledge.
I'd like to ask Madame a question. She indicated that we have about a 10% approval rating in Europe. Is this just in the last 10 years, or we have cyclical elections, and the United States is more than the current president or the last president, and we'll probably have a different point of view in another 2 years. Have we lost it that we can't get it back even if we change our policies? Or has this been a slow erosion or a rapid erosion that has taken us to these low levels? And
just a couple of two questions, perhaps. It was a quick erosion from 2002 to 2003 and then following. And the polls that the German Marshall Fund of the United States did, if you go into detailed analysis of the polls, they show quite clearly that it's more an anti-Bush kind of polling than an anti-US polling, sure. Having said that, there are some key data that show, has been said, that threat perceptions tend to be still similar, so it's not kind of all bad. We tend to have the same threat perceptions. We tend to diverge on policy solutions. So all this you can find in the figures. If you go for core questions, kind of ranking for how useful is NATO, stuff like this, you can see kind of big decreases of 25-28% from, say, 2003 to 2006-07, which is that if you had asked people in, say, 2002 or 2003 how important is NATO, you would get, for instance, in Germany, by heart, 77 or something, it's down to 52. So you see kind of subsistent erosion of, say, empathy data towards the United States. The figure I was giving you was just kind of comparing Russia and USA on the sympathy curves of average Germans. And in any way, I can't say whether that goes up. There are other pollings on the European side, and that was just my point, that just tell you that the reference frame of how to think about history and what are the things you expect from the future have dramatically changed. And if you go into detailed analysis of European data, you will find that Europeans throughout the European Union below 40 have higher expectations towards the ambitions of the European Union, want to see the European Union more independent from the United States, more on an equal footing, and have higher projections than elder Europeans throughout the European Union. This just tells you something on how the vision of the course of history will develop if you have to deal with a generation that is losing the reference frame of what we had in the past. That was just my point. In a way, I think we shouldn't be nostalgic about it and not make a pity story out of it. We should take that as it is and be, in a way, agnostic and be creative, because that's just something we can shape for the future. I think the problem, and that was your question, if you deploy public diplomacy, then yes, I guess whole Europe is waiting that this country redresses to another policy, to be honest. I mean, our polls show that quite significantly, that more or less 80% of Europeans want to see a policy change. So yes, you can expect that if policy changes here, that the polling data will also go up. But there is this kind of younger generation factor and the frame factor, which is a different one.
I think that clearly many people around the world are waiting for a policy turnaround here in the United States. But I should say, we Europeans, we should not be hypocritical, because $1 billion U.S. dollars of subsidies are paid on a daily basis for farmers, both in the United States and in Europe. So when one European blames the United States, one should look into the mirror and see what's wrong with the European Union. And it's not only that. It's the failure of the Doha trade round. So as Americans do frequently, Europeans also practice what they're preaching something, and they practice something differently. We're talking about soft power, the comparative advantage of the EU when it comes to soft power. But that's also questionable, soft power, when you try to define it analytically, soft power. And in addition, I think it's naive to believe that soft power can be projected unless there are the underpinnings, the hard power underpinnings of soft power. Soft power cannot exist on its own. There should be hard power. It is also true that hard power has to be used in a wise way. because it can destroy soft power if you use hard power in a stupid way.
Two last questions.
Question with a Turkish nuance for Ulrika Garo. Do you believe that Germany has coped better with its Turkish minority than the French have with their Moroccan and Tunisian and other Arab minorities? And if so, why? And there's a second element of this. What about this admission of Turkey to the European Union that's been dragging along for all these years? What's that all about? Who is that ever going to happen? Do you believe it should happen? And what are the factors at play here? And should the American government play any role in all this?
France, in some respect, did better with its Arab communities, and Germany did perform poorly. I mean, for sure, Germany performed very poorly. We didn't give citizenships. I mean, we are basically paying a price for 30, 40 years of missed integration policy. To some extent, I would argue that French, at least on the citizenship side and so on and so forth, France performed better with its Arabic constituencies or communities, not Turkish, but Arab. But they also pay a price, and you have heard about the riots last year. So probably we all do have problems with Muslims in Europe. They are, by the way, 20 million, which is 20 million, which is three times the Netherlands or, you know, four times Denmark. So it's a state in a state. Why should Turkey join? I mean, first, there's a legal obligation. We promised Turkey membership if it fulfills, complies with the condition 204. We are negotiating. We have opened, I think, 8 chapters as of today out of 33 chapters. Of course, Turkey will need to comply. Of course, that is not going to be quickly. We are thinking in timelines from, say, roughly 10 to 12 years. I could expect to see something serious happening on the membership question in, say, 2014 to 2017. The EU will sketch out its new budget in 2014, so I guess we need a new budget to make Turkey, in budget terms, also members. So before 2014, nothing will happen. The political point, of course, is a very, very delicate one. I mean, you have all these polity problems with Turkey, be it the Kurdish question, the Armenian question, the score of everything. So there's a religious argument. The Turkish membership is, I don't deny this, a very, very problematic question. And broadly, 2/3 of Europeans are against it. In Germany, I mean, roughly you have 1/3 of Europeans being in favor of it and 2/3 against. Having said so, 20 years ago, 2/3 of Europeans were against Spanish membership and Portuguese ones, and just 10 years ago, 80% were against Romanian membership. So things do change, and this is why basically you can run a policy discourse. With Turkey, I have to say, I'm sometimes very skeptical whether the Sarkozy government in combination with Merkel will have the political energy to have a cool and sober approach on that question. My point here is the moment we let go Turkey out of the negotiation frame, Turkey is lost. It will go radical with Iran or national with Russia or both. And as the US, as much as Europe, we will regret the moment when we had Turkey basically under control because we had it in a negotiation frame. I'm not saying that if Turkey misbehaves on many human rights issues or so on and so forth, we should not suspend negotiations, we should have a cool and sober management, but we should signal clearly to Turkey that if it complies, it is in the European Union. And I'm saying that also because I want to prove that the European Union is more than a Christian club. And I think we need that for world policy, we need it for basic geostrategic interest. I think that the US wishes that, and I think it would be the best over time. But that this is a very hot political question that needs to be carefully handled in domestic debates all over the European Union and in Turkey, this is clear. And I guess a little bit on Iran, we need to take the speed out of it because one wrong momentum and the story is lost.
Two quick points to follow up on that, if I may. The first is Ulrika is absolutely right about the stakes, about what is at stake in the Turkish membership. The disagreement is about whether those issues should be addressed by bringing Turkey into the EU or not. And you may be very well be right that the best thing to do is just to keep stretching it out and hope that time will help with respect to the other part of your question, which was what should the U.S. policy be or what is the U.S. policy, John Negroponte, who is Deputy Secretary of State and is, as a matter of fact, a former chairman of the French-American Foundation, gave a speech in Paris on the day that Sarkozy was inaugurated, and then he answered some questions from the press afterwards. And when he was asked, well, what about France's stance on Turkey's membership of the European Union, he repeated basically the same, the standard U.S. policy, which is that we are in favor of Turkey in the European Union. We hope that the French will go along with that. It wasn't quite as if Javier Solana had showed up here on Inauguration Day and come out in favor of statehood for Puerto Rico. The fact is that actually it didn't get picked up in the French press. It got a lot of press in Istanbul. But the reality is that given what's at stake, the United States has got to continue its support for Turkey, even if what's going on within the European Union means that Turkish membership is going to be difficult. It's strategically too important a country for the U.S. to walk away from that support.
Last question.
Ben, this is on. Are you on? I'm Ben Alterman, a Bezos scholar. Mr. Duggan, you spoke about responsibility. I'm wondering if you and the panel can expand on who needs to take responsibility, how, what organizations, whether it's the media, the government, individuals, and how we can do that and what we can do to help make the change.
Well, it's a big question, but since I brought up the topic, I feel obliged to at least give some semblance of an answer. I think there is a perception, both within the United States and clearly within Europe, that in a globalized world, individualism has taken over, and that we risk in the West losing our values, or at least seeing our values dissolve into a kind of void where individuals are only respected for their marginal utility and countries are only esteemed for their competitive advantage. And I think the first thing, and here I'm obviously expressing a personal opinion, I think the first thing we need to do is to figure out that as countries, as people who have benefited from the sacrifices of others, we have an overall responsibility to history to leave this place better than we found it. And I'm not sure that that we are, and when I say to leave this place, to leave the Western civilization better than we found it. You know, if we go into a globalized values-free void, what happens to the 2,500 years of Western civilization that have existed between Pericles and Athens and that we all learned about in school? It may not be there in 50 years. In addition to that, my personal conviction is that scores of millions of people did not die in the 20th century merely in order to ensure a smoothly functioning global marketplace. So I think the first thing that we have to do is to take stock of what all of this stuff means to us. And I think the fear on the part of certain Europeans is that in America in particular, but they see it happening in Europe as well, that people are essentially so caught up in their own individual daily lives, in their own, because they have this freedom that they can exercise, and there's no outside threat that requires us to deal with our daily lives or to deal with the lives of our countries with an additional sense of responsibility. I would say that we need to reintroduce fear and doubt, because fear breeds courage and doubt breeds wisdom. And I think one of the, in a very practical sense, one of the things that we could easily enough stop doing is just saying that we have to be absolutely optimistic about all sorts of things all the time, and whatever happens, we've got this kind of slap happy, yeah, this is great, let's move on and carry on. Maybe we need to step back and re-engage with fear and doubt and think about what the consequences of our actions are. Now, I'll stop my sermon there, but anyway, I hope that answers you a little bit.